This program was produced by and first broadcast on Radio Kidnappers, a volunteer-based community access station. For more information, go to www.radiokidnappers.org.nz. Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this program available through funding the Access Internet Radio Project.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium.
You're listening to Radio Kidnappers, the voice of Hawke's Bay, and I'm Lynn Trafford, presenting on behalf of the Hawke's Bay branch of the Royal Society of New Zealand, Hawke's Bay Scientists on Air. This program is your opportunity to get to know recently retired and practicing scientists from around the bay. With me in the studio, I have earth scientist Dr. Stephen Swaby, originally from the UK with a degree in geography and a PhD in isotope geochemistry of stalagmites. This researcher, lecturer, and manager has worked in many countries on a variety of fascinating aspects of science. Today we will find out how Stephen Swaby ended up in Hawke's Bay and what work he is involved in currently. Welcome to Radio Kidnappers, Dr. Stephen Swaby.
Thank you very much.
It's lovely to have you with us. And our listeners, of course, now know that you are originally from the UK. But where did you grow up? Where did you go to school?
Well, I was born in Yorkshire and spent most of my life in Yorkshire as a child, living in a village called Great Ayton, which is one of the villages that Captain Cook lived in Yorkshire for many years.
So a nice tie with New Zealand, right?
Yes,
from the word go.
And many other places too.
Uh-huh.
And it's just south of Middlesbrough in North Yorkshire, yes. So almost up in County Durham.
You have not got quite the accent.
No, I had to lose my Yorkshire accent when I moved to New Zealand originally because I was teaching at the university in Auckland.
And no one could understand
my
you.
My poor students couldn't understand my accent.
Fair enough too. I have trouble with it too. Anyway, was there a particular time in your studies as a young lad when you got turned on to science and geography? I know that's been your career. So how did it start?
Well, as a child, I was living in a village which was very close to the North Yorkshire Moors, and I'd spend a lot of time out and about on my bicycle and on foot exploring, and I was constantly asking the question, why? Why does the hill slope look like that? Why is there that feature in the field? Why has the river flowed that way and not this way? And as a consequence, when I was studying at school and when I went on to university, I followed courses which allowed me to try and understand some of those issues. And that inevitably led to geography, which is the degree I did at university.
So you left home and you went off to Oxford for your first degree, geography?
Yep, that's right.
Now, I read in the notes that I was looking through before we came on air that part of the studying that you did whilst you were at Oxford took place in the Cook Islands. And I thought that was really jolly funny, really. How does a young lad in Oxford in England end up doing research and study in the Cook Islands? It's about as far away from home as you can get, isn't it?
Just about. It's not quite the Antipodes, but it's close.
Nearly is, yeah.
The work that I had to do at Oxford as part of my degree included a research investigation, and they're called dissertations at undergraduate level. And we were expected to do either a human geography or a physical geography dissertation. And in my year before going to university, I'd spent some time travelling in the South Pacific. And I'd visited the island of Mitiaro, which is in the Cook Islands, and been quite fascinated by the way in which the groundwater in the island is exposed in caves. So you see the freshwater springs and the freshwater caves from which the islanders take their drinking water and their cooking water exposed in lots of different places on the island. And looking for an excuse to return, I put two and two together and made an expedition out of it. And the expedition was an accredited Oxford University expedition, which meant that I got the support of the Royal Geographical Society and a number of other funders. And it essentially allowed me to go and do some physical geography research in the Cook Islands, whilst having expedition
a nice
supported.
Time.
Yes. Well, it was certainly interesting fun, but very hard work at the same time. It's difficult to do science in the middle of the Pacific.
Cook Islands.
Yes.
as a young lad, yes, I'm sure it was a very, very interesting time, but also a very good basis for you to build upon, because that particular degree was not the end of your study. Back you go, having concluded the study, back you go to yet more study, a PhD study. Tell me about your PhD study, please, Stephen.
So you're right, it followed naturally from one to the other. So my undergraduate dissertation dealt with the way in which the hydrogeology of the island functioned, so how the groundwater moved around the island, and that meant I spent a lot of time caving. I'd be underground with sample bottles and pH meters looking at the way in which the hydrogeology functioned. And when I saw advertised a PhD position, a funded position, to examine cave stalagmites and what they tell us about climate change, I leapt at the opportunity and applied, and luckily got it. And what that meant was I spent about 3 years doing field work all over northwest Europe, from Scotland through Ireland, Wales, England, northern Spain, and Portugal, looking at cave stalagmites, taking samples from them, and looking at their geochemistry to try and understand how climate had changed over about the last 15,000 years.
I was just guessing, because we have similar kinds of caves here in New Zealand, so I was kind of guessing that whilst you were doing this up in Europe, would there maybe have been some other PhD students down here in New Zealand doing exactly the same sort of work or very similar kinds of work with our caves down here?
Similar sorts of work's been done in New Zealand a long time ago by PhD students, but there's a university researcher by the name of Professor Paul Williams, who was teaching at the time in Auckland and has recently retired but continues his research, who's been doing very similar sorts of things down here too. So yes, similar sorts of studies down under.
And have you been to our caves down here in New Zealand and had a good look round?
I have. I used to be president of the New Zealand Speleological Society, the caving group.
Yep.
And it meant I've spent quite a lot of time underground doing research and also just enjoying going caving.
Yeah, it's nice. It's a good place to do it, isn't it? We're very lucky to have those here, I suppose.
There's really lots and lots of caves in New Zealand.
Yeah,
yes,
there are. Yeah. And some really pretty ones and some very interesting ones as well. Anyway, so this was the basis of your PhD. What happened to you after your PhD?
Well, I had a choice. Whilst I'd been doing my PhD, I'd supported myself doing IT training work and IT support work. I have a bit of an aptitude for computers and databases and programming and so on. And I was offered three jobs on the same day when I left my PhD work. One was teaching at the University in Auckland as a temporary lecturer, and two were in IT working as a programmer or a database analyst. And the University of Auckland job paid the least, and that's the one I took.
Oh, surprise, surprise, Stephen. Oh, poor Auckland. Okay.
Well, it was a consequence of the way in which the exchange rate was at the time, I think, mostly.
Hopefully, yes, one hastens to add, yes. All right, so where did you go then?
Well, off to Auckland, and I spent almost 5 years teaching a variety of courses at the university there, ranging from introductory geoscience courses, mostly in geography, through to some of the master's programs in hydrology, and particularly in karst research and karst matters.
Now, can we just explain to the listeners what karst is?
Yep.
So karst, it links back to your PhD again, doesn't it?
And yes, to my undergraduate work. So karst are the landforms that characterise a landscape where there's lots of limestone present. So it's things like caves and dolines, which are little depressions in the ground down which water flows, often with a cave at the bottom of them, and a variety of other features like the fluted rocks that you see, for example, at Waitomo. There's lots of them there. Limestone rock faces with very sharp, knife-like edges on them. And it's a name which derives from the area of Serbia known as Kras. It's been Germanified to karst. And it is a description for a range of studies in geology and geomorphology and hydrology to do with this particular type of landscape.
I would like you, we sort of skipped over it, but there's a very nice story in your life that I'd like you to relate at this time, because I know that you went through your secondary schooling not particularly liking mathematics. And in England, one studies at the O levels and A levels, which is not quite what we do here, but that happens, what, in year 13?
The O levels. 17 or 18.
Yes, yeah. So in your last year at school, you're studying these O levels. Knowing that you didn't particularly like mathematics, and here you are all these years later, really quite tied up in it. Can you just tell the listeners what happened for your A levels?
So A levels are the exams that you do just before you go to university. And in Britain, you choose 4 or 5 subjects that you study and are examined on. And it's fairly common to choose things that you enjoy and things that you're good at doing, because that makes it easier to do the exams.
Well, you're going to pass, aren't you, then?
Well, that's right.
Yes.
And I chose a number of things that I enjoyed: geography, economics. You generally do general studies as a topic. And then I knew that I was struggling with maths, but I knew that I'd also need maths in what I was doing later in life. So I chose to study maths as a topic at A-level, knowing that I would really struggle with it. And I was right. I did struggle at it. I didn't get a good grade at the end, but I learned an awful lot. And it also meant that when I got to my degree and when I've used maths later in life, I've got a basis for my understanding of the processes outside mathematics that use maths and statistics to explain what's going on in the world.
And I thank you for telling us that little story, because I think it's nice if we've got anyone out there listening at the moment whose children or grandchildren might be contemplating going off to university next year for a degree. It just proves that learning the basic fundamentals, it's worth doing it, isn't it? You don't have to be the world's best practitioner, but if you know a little bit about the basic fundamentals, it will help you so much more later on in life. So thank you for sharing with us. I think that rather nice little story. Did you tell your students at university about this?
Oh, absolutely, yes. A lot of them would struggle with maths as well, and I used to explain some of the tricks I learned from my very good maths teacher about how to shortcut some of the very long-winded processes that maths employs to get to the answer much more quickly and easily.
Yeah, it's good to be able to share stories like that, isn't it? So you lectured in Tasmania at Launceston and in New Zealand in Auckland. Were there similarities in what you were doing?
To a degree. So the Tasmanian University course was dealing with physical sciences, so a much broader range of science than just earth sciences and geography.
Did you enjoy that?
Oh, it's great fun. Yeah, I was based in a university campus at Launceston, the University of Tasmania, where there was an aquaculture program going on at the same time. And it was a real shame at the end of each of the semesters when the research was being concluded to have to eat the experiments on crayfish and other things.
Oh, no, you ate them.
Yes, very nice.
Crayfish Mornay. Mm. All right, that sounds really, really interesting. That work in Australia that you were doing, you later on went to work there permanently, didn't you?
In Australia, that's right, yes. Yeah. In the last 5 years, I've been working in Newcastle, just north of Sydney, as a consultant for an environmental company. And I've been doing a lot of different sorts of work, including earth sciences and climate change, so harkening back to my training, but also working on spatial data and programming software.
The work that has been done over there, that you were doing over there, is an ongoing work, is it not? The fact that you had left and moved on from that company, the work that you were doing is still carrying on?
That's right. So the software that we were writing as a team is something designed to handle very large volumes of spatial data. So a type
What were you doing with it, Stephen? Where did all this data come from, and what does one do with it?
So this is data that's collected from an aircraft, usually, and it's collected by firing a laser at the ground. And when the laser bounces back to the aircraft, it's detected, and the detection tells you what it's hit, whether it's hit water or the ground or a building or a road. And it also tells you precisely in space where that point was when it did hit. And it's known as LIDAR, and it stands for light detection and ranging. It's a bit like radar, which is radio detection and ranging. And LIDAR is a very interesting sort of observational data, because you can collect a very large volume very quickly. And it's not uncommon to collect about 2 terabytes of data in a single data set. And 2 terabytes would be enough to fill up most computers' hard disks completely. So one of the problems with that, of course, is managing that large volume of data and finding things within it. So what my team was doing and what we programmed software to do was to look through these extremely large data sets and find very small objects within them. And the thing that we specifically concentrated on was something that causes ecologists and biogeographers real problems, and that's finding mallee-fowl mounds.
And these are?
Right. So a mallee-fowl is a bird that's mostly protected in Australia in all the different states.
Oh,
that
okay.
That rather than sitting on its eggs, it buries them in a mound of soil and leaf litter that is carefully arranged by the birds to incubate the eggs at a specific temperature. The trouble with that is that when you're trying to find these mallee-fowl mounds, they're very often out in the middle of nowhere, so in the middle of the bush. They're quite small, between about a metre high and about 2 metres in diameter, and something a bit smaller than that. And normally when you're trying to find them as an ecologist, you get lots of your friends together and you walk across the country within eyeshot of each other, eyesight of each other, and you try and see where these things are on the ground, because they're not obvious from aircraft when you're looking at them from a helicopter or from an aeroplane. So this is very time-consuming and very expensive, but it's required when you're, for example, opening a new mine, because you have to identify where these protected birds might be nesting. So what we did with LiDAR data and the software we wrote was write a special detection routine to find mallee-fowl mounds within the data, provide a list of the potential mounds to ecologists who could then go straight to those positions and check whether the thing that we found in the data really was a mallee-fowl mound or not. And we obtained a patent on that process, which has been quite an exciting thing for the company, because it's quite difficult to patent software, because normally software isn't seen as being sufficiently novel. But this was sufficiently novel that we got a patent for it.
It is unusual, isn't it? Mm. And so were you being hired by the government, by the mine people? Who was hiring you to do this kind of work?
Well, we developed the software in response to a number of our clients who were spending lots of time and money doing this sort of work, and they asked us, could we find a better way of doing it?
Mm.
But it was intended to be used by multiple clients, and certainly the miners and the mining companies were very keen, because they have to be able to demonstrate where mallee-fowl mounds exist. But each of the governments that manage mallee-fowl as a conservation issue were also interested in using new tools to find the mallee-fowl mounds in the field.
Mm. An interesting application. I would never have guessed something like that would come out of a spatial data analysis. It's an exciting thing to be involved in, I would think. You have in other times of your research life worked around different parts of the world as well. Was the work that you were doing in other areas as exciting as that, or as unusual as that?
Oh, there's lots of opportunities when you're a geographer to do all sorts of exciting things. So over the years, I've done obviously the work in the Cook Islands.
Which involved, that started it, I suppose.
It
didn't
did,
it?
And
that's, yes.
That involved cave diving, which is pretty exciting to do when you're doing your undergraduate work. Closely followed by an expedition to the Krakatoa Islands between Java and Sumatra.
Famous down here, we know about them.
Yeah, exactly. And then more recently, I've had opportunities to work in Samoa for the government, helping them with their climate change and disaster risk work, and also for a mining company in Senegal in West Africa, where I was managing the environmental assessments that they were doing as part of their application for their program of work with both the government of Senegal and also their funders who were providing them the money to do their work.
Interesting, all interesting aspects that probably as a young lad you never thought you were going to be doing all those kinds of things all over the world.
Quite.
And hence the knowledge of French. I know this is just a sort of a byproduct of the science, I suppose, but must have come in very handy when one went out to Senegal to work out there. How did you end up in New Zealand though, Stephen?
Well, I came here to respond to an advertisement that had been put in the general press worldwide by Professor Paul Williams, who was looking for a lecturer to cover the lectures that he was giving at the time whilst he went off and did some research. And I'd seen this and applied and very luckily got the job.
Did he know of your work that you were doing, your research that you were doing Because there was a bit of a match-up there, wasn't there?
Well, that's right. So he's obviously interested in similar things in,
yes,
in his research program to what he was teaching. That's generally the case in universities. And those are the things that I'd also looked at in my PhD work. He wouldn't have been aware of them until I provided him with my CV, I suspect, though.
It might have just helped, huh?
It would have helped.
It would have just helped. That's good. So other than the teaching in Auckland at the university, what other work have you done in New Zealand?
Well, I've also worked for a couple of the regional councils and currently work for a regional council.
We'll get to that one in a minute. Do the other one first, huh?
Okay. So I've worked at Otago Regional Council as the manager of their natural hazards work program.
So when did you go there?
It was in about 2003.
And how did you end up down there at Otago?
Well, the program of work at University of Auckland came to an end as Professor Williams transitioned back from research into teaching, and so the temporary position I had ended, and this job was advertised in Otago, and it fitted with my research in earth sciences and my interests in engaging with community on these issues, and they very kindly took me on.
There was a mix of work down there that you were doing in this area. I mean, in New Zealand, we're very good at natural hazards, aren't we? They come naturally to us.
We've really got lots of experience.
We do
certainly
have lots, yes, of experience. And I'm sure that the sort of work that you were doing down there in Otago is also the sort of work that led you up here to the regional council. Well, I know we'll run out of time, so maybe if we can mull the two in together a little bit, because I want to talk about the work that your scientists are doing here at the regional council in Hawke's Bay, and I know that some of that will include seismic risk, coastal flooding, tsunami investigations. The sorts of stuff that was going on down there is going on here as well, isn't it?
It is going on here, but my team doesn't actually do much work in that sort of space at the moment. Uh-huh. So we support the engineers and the natural hazards analysts here by providing information, particularly on coasts and rivers. But the scientists do a separate body of work, which is mostly around monitoring the state of the environment and understanding what pressures mean for the environment by looking at specific issues and catchments around the region.
So when did you come to Hawke's Bay?
This time around about 18 months ago.
About 18 months ago. And can we just tell the listeners what your role really is with the council?
So
what's your title and what do you do?
So I'm the manager of environmental sciences, and I look after a team of about 30 scientists split
That's
into five major areas.
Yep. Yes.
Well, I have some team leaders in that team who look after each of the individual teams, and I assist them in managing the work programs that the teams have. So there's a team that works on freshwater ecology, and they do a lot of work also in the coastal space, looking particularly at ecology. Then there's a team which looks after land science, so a range of things from soils to freshwater environments, particularly riparian strips. There's a team that looks after both freshwater and groundwater quantity and quality, and so rivers and underground water. And then there's a team who manage all the monitoring equipment that we have around the region. And we collect an awful lot of data from a wide range of different sites. And they both install and maintain those sites and also bring the data back and quality check it. And then finally, there's one single person who looks after both air quality and climate work.
I'm rather interested in the collection of data that's going along. And you're doing this by some unusual methods, are you not?
Well, there's a variety of different things that we do which are relatively new in New Zealand. So one of the things we try and avoid is, for example, getting people into rivers, because rivers have a tendency to sweep you away and it can be quite tricky in flood conditions. So we use remote-controlled boats, for example, to monitor gauging of rivers, and that saves people having to get into their waders and wade out into fast-flowing streams.
It's taken the fun out of it.
Oh, no. I can imagine driving a remote-controlled boat up and down a river is great fun.
I would think so. Do you use drones?
We don't ourselves, but there are people at council investigating the potential use, because it does save a lot of time and money.
Similarly to your remote-controlled boats, I suppose. It's the same sort of development, isn't it? Stephen, I know that over the years for your work that you have done, you have received acknowledgements and awards. For example, you're a fellow of the Royal Geographic Society. When did that happen?
After I'd been on the two expeditions to the Cook Islands and to Krakatoa, I was asked whether I'd like to apply for fellowship. And it's not a particularly difficult thing to get.
It's still an honour. Not everyone is a fellow, just as well.
But there are many people who are, who come from not just academic walks of life, but also from everyday explorers who perhaps haven't even studied geography. But I'm also a member of the professional geomorphology group. So I'm a chartered geographer, geomorphology, which means my qualifications and capabilities have been assessed against criteria that they use for achieving an appropriate professional grade.
And you are the newest member of the Hawke's Bay branch of the Royal Society Council. So you joined the council at the beginning of July in this year, 2015. So it's nice to have you on board as part of the Royal Society
Thank
Council
you very much.
As well. And who knows, one day you might be a fellow of the Royal Society. That would be pretty whip-de-doo.
I can dream, yes.
We quite like to have that one happen as well. We are running out of time, and I know we have very briefly just breezed through some of the things that you have done in your life, and with some areas we've not done them a lot of justice, but it's great to have you in the Bay. It's good to have you at the Regional Council, and I'm sure that we'll hear more about you as your time here goes on. On behalf of the Hawke's Bay branch of the Royal Society of New Zealand and of Radio Kidnappers, thank you, Dr. Stephen Swaby, for being my guest on Hawke's Bay Scientists on Air. To find out more about Earth Science Studies in New Zealand, scientists and their work under the auspices of the Hawke's Bay Regional Council, or the role and work of the Royal Society in New Zealand, a Google search will help you in the first instance and bog you under with lots and lots of information. Please join me on the second and third Mondays of the month at 9:30 in the morning to meet another practicing or recently retired Hawke's Bay scientist. I'm Lynn Trafford.
This program was produced by and first broadcast on Radio Kidnappers, a volunteer-based community access station. For more information, go to www.radiokidnappers.org.nz. Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this program available through funding the Access Internet Radio Project.